MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It is that time of the week. It's a Tuesday afternoon, and Dr. Ross Walker joins me on the phone. Hello, Ross.
Good afternoon, Brent. How are you, my friend?
I'm well, thank you. Let's get stuck into some of the questions that I've got for you, if you don't mind, today.
Sure.
This is from Helen. She says, I've been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation.
Yep.
Is this a serious condition? My GP has put me on, is it Zareleta?
Xarelto.
Xarelto, one tablet daily, and Metrol, half a tablet twice a day.
Yep.
She has a cardiologist appointment in April. She said her father passed away from a heart attack when he was 68. She is now 72.
Yep. Look, it's the commonest significant heart rhythm disturbance, but I would see every day three or four people with atrial fibrillation. I've seen already three or four today. And it's the sort of thing where, with the right sort of management, it doesn't reduce your life by 1 millisecond. Now, what the Xarelto does is stop Helen from having a stroke, which is the big disaster with atrial fibrillation. The Xarelto thins the blood, stops any clots forming in the atrium so you don't have a stroke from it. And the important thing is, if you can be kept in a good rhythm with whatever drugs work for you, so metoprolol, half a tablet twice a day, may be all she needs. There are stronger drugs that can be used. There's also ablation techniques that are being used, which I prefer to reserve for people below the age of 65, because I just don't like prolonged anesthesia in older people. But really, it's not something to be disturbed about. But it's that, remember the old days, they used to say, be aware but not alarmed. And that's the whole point about this. You don't have to be alarmed about having atrial fibrillation, but you do need to have regular follow-up with a cardiologist.
This Xarelto, is that like a warfarin?
Yeah. In the old days, warfarin was the only drug we had that really thinned the blood enough to stop clots forming in the atrium of the heart. So people say, what about aspirin? Aspirin only works for the artery. So if you've got a stent or a heart attack or a bypass, it's a high flow state. You don't need a stronger blood thinner. But when you've got a problem in the atrium, which is a low flow state, it's easier for clots to form. So in the old days, we used to use warfarin. But the problem with warfarin is that you've got to have blood tests. You've got to watch what you eat, what you drink, what pills you take. There's so many interactions with it, and the levels go all over the place. So that's why you have to have regular blood tests. But drugs like Xarelto, which don't work anywhere the same as warfarin does, work totally differently. You don't need blood tests. Yes, you still are at a higher risk of bleeding because it makes your blood thinner, because that's what it's supposed to do, but they're just safer drugs. So the only time we use warfarin these days now is for people that have mechanical prosthetic heart valves, and everyone else can use the drugs like Xarelto for things like atrial fibrillation.
My dad was on warfarin, and I just remember it changed his life completely.
Yeah, well, these drugs don't do that.
Okay. I'm 61-year-old. I'm a 61-year-old female. This is from Annie. I'm a 61-year-old female who has quite good health for my age. However, I've just been given a diagnosis of HOCM.
Yep.
And wonder how bad this condition is and what, if anything, can be done about it. Thank you, Dr. Ross.
Okay, so HOCM stands for hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. And what it is, it's a genetic disorder of the heart where the heart walls get excessively thick. Now, sometimes, because the heart's getting so thick, that the outlet part of the heart, called the left ventricular outflow tract, can get blocked, and that's where the obstructive part of it comes from. And the interesting thing is that it's really, in many cases, disease before 50, disease after 50, which is true for many other conditions as well. So if you had hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy in your 20s, it can be, not always, but maybe a lethal condition. But if you develop it over the age of 50, it's nowhere near as severe. Your long-term prognosis is excellent. We've just mentioned metoprolol, which is one of the beta blockers, one of the standard drugs used to treat hypertrophic cardiomyopathy as well as atrial fibrillation. And it tends to keep people under very good control. There are other drugs that can be used. Very occasionally, you can have surgery where you shave off a little bit of the thickened septum. And sometimes, if this is an interesting treatment, they do what's called alcohol septal ablation, where they do a catheter on the heart, and on the septal branches of one of the arteries, inject a bit of alcohol in it, it basically just kills that little bit of the heart and shrinks the heart down a bit. So there's a lot of things that can be done for it. The prognosis at the age of 61 is pretty good, but she shouldn't be playing first grade squash or doing running marathons. But apart from that, follow the cardiologist's advice and she should be fine.
Adam says, what's the best drug on the market to boost my testosterone and libido? I'm 49 years of age, a married male. I take Keppra for epilepsy. And the little blue pill doesn't do the job. And Adam has a sense of humour. He signs it, happy wife, happy life.
Yeah, okay. If he's having those sort of issues where his testosterone is very low, now, see, a lot of people just assume they have low testosterone because their libido is low. And a lot of people listening to this think libido and erectile function are the same things. They're two entirely different things. Libido is desire. Erectile function is how good an erection you get. And so what Adam needs is a thorough workup with an endocrinologist who has expertise in this area, who will measure all parameters of testosterone function. So there's not just one blood test. You need to have a blood test that looks at a whole lot of different parameters and then decide what treatment is effective. So, for example, some people can get a testosterone implant every 6 months that can give them good erectile function. And it's also the right way to use the erectile dysfunction drugs. Often they're not given the right sort of advice, and it's not an appropriate forum for me to be telling people how to use all these things. But I'm saying there are a lot of things that can be done for this situation, but he does need a full workup with an endocrinologist who has an interest and expertise in sexual health.
If you have erectile dysfunction, is Viagra what, I suppose, is Viagra the tablet, the only tablet you can take to fix that?
No, and it's what I call vitamin V, Viagra. And in fact, I spoke on my show on Sunday night about a big study that was done on 260,000 men over 5 years. Those who were the highest end users of Viagra or Cialis, which is one of the other drugs, had a 18% reduction in progression to dementia. Another study that was done about 12 months ago, 72,000 men over 14 years, found that those who were the highest end users of Viagra and Cialis had a 55% reduction in cardiac events, a 50% reduction in all-cause death, who used them regularly. Now, why is that the case? It's the case because they open up all the arteries in the body, just not what most men believe to be the most important artery. And so therefore, I encourage all of my male patients to use these drugs regularly because they're vasodilators. They open up arteries and wash all the crap out. And that's why they're good for you. So they're good things to take. But I'm saying in a specific case like Adam's, who's a younger man, who's got other health issues, he's on Keppra for other reasons, he needs to have a full workup and have this sorted out properly.
What are the side effects of something like a Viagra for someone, you know, over the age of 60?
Yeah. Well, the typical side effects are that you get flushing, so red face, sinus issues, headaches. They're the typical side effects. You should never take them with a group of cardiac drugs called nitrates. So there's a drug called Imdur, the little pill you put under your tongue if you have angina. You should never combine them because it drops your blood pressure to the boots. And when it first came out, when Viagra first came out about 25 years ago onto the market, there were a few deaths, but the deaths weren't because of Viagra. The deaths were because of activities that people hadn't done for a long time, they're now able to do, and that's what killed them, not the Viagra.
What about the mixing of alcohol and Viagra?
Oh, look, again, if you're going to make love and you drink alcohol, it's going to affect your performance. There's no real interaction. There is another what's called PDE5 inhibitor, which is the same group of drugs. So there's Viagra, which is short-acting. You take it an hour before, and that's how it works. Cialis is a long-acting drug, has a 36-hour half-life, so some people take a low dose, 5 milligrams every second day. Levitra is another one which is said not to have as much interaction with alcohol. Some people use that. And there's another one that's a rapid-onset one called Spedra, which works as well. So there's a whole lot of different drugs that do have an effect in this area.
You talk about erectile dysfunction, being, you know, very careful to choose my words here. Yeah. What percentage of men over the age of 60 suffer from this?
Well, what I say is that all of us over the age of 50, everything stiffens up apart from the bit you want to.
Right.
And so it becomes progressively more common every decade. So you start, say, you look in the 30s, it's quite unusual, but still happens. In the 40s, it might be 5 to 10%. In the 50s, it might be 10 to 20%. In the 60s, 20 to 30%. 70s, you know, it just keeps going.
What causes it?
Well, in many ways, there's a whole lot of different reasons. Firstly, atherosclerosis, which is a thing that causes heart attack and stroke. If you think about it, the penile artery sits out of the body useless for most of the day, and then you expect it to be an athlete for a few minutes every now and then. So if you're not keeping exercising it, then it does get floppy and doesn't work that well, especially if you get a bit of fat build up in the penile artery. But there's also a whole lot of psychologic factors. The pelvic floor gets looser in men as it does in women as we get older. Multifactorial reasons, and also the testosterone that Adam mentioned as well. As the testosterone drops, then you don't get as good a erectile function as well.
We're talking to Dr. Ross Walker. That's a couple of questions answered. As you can see, he's terrific and very thorough. If you've got a question for him, please email it to me and we'll put it to the good doctor next week. We are talking to Dr. Ross Walker this afternoon. Ross, diets don't work. Oh, my goodness. The yo-yo dieting. They've done some research. I suppose we don't need to be Einstein to work out that diets just don't work, do they?
No, about 20 years ago, mate, I wrote a book titled, strangely, Diets Don't Work. And basically the point I was making there is you go on a diet like you go on a holiday. What happens when you go on a holiday? You come back. What happens when you go on a diet? You stop. And this is yet another study to show that anyone who goes on yo-yo dieting thinking they're going to solve a problem, these ridiculous 12-week programs, because as soon as you stop the programs, they might work whilst you're on them, but they stop when you stop doing whatever you're doing. So, for example, this study was done on 36 adults, 13 men, 23 women, and just looked at their habit of weight cycling, whether they went on a fad diet, they were the quick lose weight quick fix plans, or even using drugs. The bottom line here is as soon as you stop these programs, the flab comes back on. So the first month of any diet, you lose water and muscle. You don't actually lose what you want to lose, which is fat. So you think, oh, wow, I've lost 5 kilos, but you've really just lost mainly water and muscle and a bit of superficial fat. But you've got to see the fat that you really want to lose, which is the ingrained visceral fat, the stuff that's really deep in the body. And it's like an archaeologic dig. It takes months and months and months of chipping away before you see any benefit. And this is why preventative health is a really hard sell, because people are happy to go and pay thousands of dollars for cosmetic surgery because they see an immediate effect. And I think a lot of cosmetic surgery just makes people look different. It doesn't make them look better. But in terms of getting a long-term benefit, preventative health takes months and months to work, and it's so slow, and people just don't have the patience to wait for it.
Well, let's jump to medical myth for this week. You can outrun a bad diet. Come on, no, you can't.
No, you can't, and that's the myth. The myth that people think, oh, look, I do so much exercise, I can eat what I like, and it's just not true. And this was a study out of Harvard University, 100,000 adults followed up for 30 years, so a huge study, showing that those who had a regular exercise habit reduced their risk for cardiovascular disease by 50%. So the Walker suggested dose, 3 to 5 hours every week of moderate exertion. And that's been proven time and time again in every study to reduce all sorts of diseases anywhere between 30 to 50%. But there's a but. If you then have a couple of soft drinks a week, you start to really significantly reduce that benefit. And if you have a soft drink every day, and can you believe, Brent, there are people out there who would have a soft drink every day of their life? It's just outrageous.
Well, look, I can, because there are people out there that, you know, I suppose as the sun goes down, they love a G&T, and they think the tonic's good for them, but it's actually a soft drink.
Yeah, it's a soft drink and it's full of sugar. And there's nothing wrong with having, say, one gin and tonic a week, but there's a hell of a lot of having one every day because of the sugar and the other stuff that's in the soft drink. So, but there's a lot of people who don't drink alcohol. So I don't drink alcohol at all, and they have soft drink.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, but it's okay because I have the diet
that's
stuff.
That's right.
And the diet stuff's almost as bad as the normal stuff. So no, you cannot outrun a bad diet.
You were saying, and you say on a regular basis, 3 to 5 hours exercise a week.
Yeah.
You said that a couple of weeks ago, and I got this email from someone that was listening to us, and he said, that Porsche driving punce, how can you do 3 to 5 hours exercise a day? He doesn't know what he's talking about.
And he doesn't listen.
Hey?
The very, very fine gentleman who's vulgar enough to make that comment should actually listen to what's being said.
Exactly.
I never say 3 to 5 hours a day. No one can do that unless you're a professional athlete, moron.
I laughed. I thought they have to, firstly, please clean wax out of ears.
Yeah, that's it. Actually listen to what's being said.
Music boosts the brain. Yes, playing a musical instrument or singing in a choir may boost your brain, Ross.
Yeah, interestingly, in the 90s, a study was published in Nature talking about the Mozart effect, and they were talking more about listening to music. But this is a bigger study that's looked at people who have played a musical instrument at some stage in their life or continue to do so, or people who sing in a choir, and it showed that when they tested their brain function, their memory, their executive functions, they were so much better. So it's just one of the more pieces of evidence that strengthen the fact that music is incredibly good for our bodies. In fact, I interviewed a guy on my show a few years ago who is using music as a therapy for people with dementia. And I thought to myself a few years back, you know what we should be doing? At about age 60, we should be writing in our living will our 50 favourite pieces of music, so that if and when we ever develop mild cognitive impairment, these things should be played for us. Because this guy was saying he'd have people who'd be sitting in a corner completely out of it, and you'd play the music they loved and it would animate them, and you could see a completely different person. So music is incredible therapy. In fact, the man who just walked out of my room just before we started this segment is a musician. He's in his late 70s and he still plays music all around Sydney every weekend. It's just superb.
They say that listening to music, though, doesn't give you the same benefits.
No. Look, I think listening to music is great, but singing in a choir and playing an instrument yourself is so much better for you.
And it's never too old. You're never too late to start learning to play music.
No. I'm quite happy to say that I've played guitar since the age of 10.
Have you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I used to be lead singer, rhythm guitarist in a very poor rock band many, many years ago.
God, you've got so many hidden talents.
And still really built out Mustang Sally at all of my children's weddings and any private functions. I can belt it out.
We'll get you to do it on the radio one day. That's fantastic. Dr. Ross, it's always a delight and a treat to talk to you. Thank you so much. We enjoy our Tuesday afternoons. You have a good week. Practice that Mustang Sally, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Good on you, mate.
See you, mate. I've got a new theme for you now. We'll do a new intro with Mustang Sally.
That'll be wonderful. Okay.
Okay, Ross. See you, mate.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Dr. Ross Walker. He's good, isn't he? Mustang Sally. I must remember that. If you've got any questions for the doctor, please send them to me via email. Go to the 2SM website. Look for the drop-down list and send your questions to Brent Bultitude.